Hello from Delinea, and welcome to the show. If you've been enjoying the 401 Access Denied podcast, then make sure to like, follow, and subscribe so that you don't miss any future episodes. We'd love to hear from you. Join the discussion by leaving us a comment or a review on your platform of choice, or by emailing us at podcast@delinea.com. From all of us at Delinea, thank you and enjoy the show.
Hello everyone, welcome to an episode of the 401 Access Denied podcast. I'm the host, Joe Carson, and Chief Security Scientist and Advisor at CISO Delinea, and it's a pleasure. We have a very special edition of the podcast today. Very rarely do we get to do a episode in person, so which is actually something that we haven't done in a long, long, long time. So it's really great to do an episode with actually a person face-to-face. And this episode, I'm joined with Lewis. So Lewis, as the guest, do you want to give us a bit of a background about yourself? And also, you do a podcast yourself. Give us a background about your podcast.
Sure. So my name is Lewis Ezran. I'm Australian. I've lived in Estonia here, where Joseph also lives, for about 15 years. I run a stand-up comedy production company called Comedy Estonia. That's wild. I'm also an old-school retro gamer. I have a podcast called the Zez Retro YouTube channel. I just talk about stuff I like. I have my good friend, Steve Nutter, and he's one of the industry experts on restoring and repairing old CRT monitors, the old big box TVs. So we have a podcast called the Cathode Ray Podcast. We're talking about Steve's repairs, and it's very fascinating. So I'm interested in console mods, I'm interested in hacking, and I'm also interested in repairing old TV sets as well.
Fantastic. And actually, in Estonia, there's a lot of TV sets to repair, especially really retro ones, really old school. And that's what we're really here to talk about today, is that there's a very strong relationship between the world of hacking and the gaming world, especially the retro gaming. And for many of people, you know, who don't really know, maybe my background is, my background started in gaming. Okay. That was actually my entire career. For the kind of building up to it, I spent a lot of my youth doing gaming. And that was where kind of, for me, it was a very interesting area. But then I started understanding about modifying them and trying to win the games and complete the games. Because when I was a kid, one of the things was, we had a massive competition with all the other school friends and people in the community, was around how many games you could complete. And you wanted to be the winner. So for me, I think the big thing around this relationship between hacking and gaming is so strong. And it has really the foundation. A lot of the hackers I know in the world today that kind of I work with, they started in the same background. They started in gaming, moved into IT or system administrator, and then moved into the hacking world. So for me, there's a big, strong relationship. And you've kind of spent a lot of your youth doing gaming.
Sure, the same. So let's set the precedent here. What were you working on? What systems or what sort of games? Give us that, paint that picture for us.
Sure, absolutely. So basically, when the first game console that I ever got to play was the Atari 2600.
Nice.
That was the first, and it was, when I was younger, I used to basically travel from, originally from Belfast, from Northern Ireland. And we did this travel to Europe, to mainland, and I went to Belgium every year. And the kids that I went to in Belgium, they had an Atari 2600. And all we did all day long was play games, tanks, basically, you know, ping pong, all the kind of the really kind of famous games back then, Donkey Kong. So for me, that was the first games console. Then, so when I came back, one of the things I wanted was a games console. I wanted my own. And my parents, it was very hard to get the games consoles. It was not easy. They were actually quite expensive at the time. So my parents came with the next best thing, which was an Atari 800 XL, which was a kind of like, it was a computer, but it also had games cartridges that you could play.
Right. Was that before the Atari ST?
It was the Atari ST.
Oh, okay, it was Atari ST.
So it was Atari 800 XL. So it was actually the next version up from the Atari ST. And for me, it basically, of course, it was in basic programming. So you had to start learning how to program. So I started actually not only playing the games, because it came with a cartridge, but it also came with a tape cassette. And for me, basically, one of the things I wanted to do was, like, you know, create my own. So I started creating my own games. I was about maybe 8 or 9 years old, and started creating things like football league stats and games, and then quizzes. And then I started doing the in magazine games. We actually had to type the code from the magazines. And then you'd find like a month later that they made a mistake in the original one, and you'd have to go back later and correct, because you were like, what was the runtime error? Why was it not working? So that was that Atari 800XL. That was my first system. And that was really set me off into the world of, you know, exploration, hacking, coding, and gaming.
I think that that you said you're from Northern Ireland. Sorry, was it from Northern Ireland? Now I'm from Australia, but I think there was something special that happened around that time in the United Kingdom, in the Anglo, even in Australia, we got the blowback from it, right? I had an Amiga 500. And I had access to also, a few months late, but all the computer magazines, Amiga Power, CVG, all that sort of. So I'm absorbing this UK gaming culture. I've got an Amiga 500. You had the Atari, very, very similar platforms. And that, there was a homebrew scene then. And it was the magazines that you talked about. The kids, do you know there used to be code in magazines and you would have to type that out. Because there was no discs. This is before discs were even on the front. So this is something I think our American and other international friends may not have had. There was a particular UK kind of Anglo hacking. It was the Sinclair. It was a C64. You know, Commodore, Atari did this.
And that was
part
of
the scene. Yeah,
yeah. The two distinct communities back then was you know what we have today. Well, it used to be Nintendo versus Sega.
Sure.
Before that, it was basically the Commodore versus the Sinclair Spectrum. So that was, you know, you either were a Sinclair Spectrum person or you were the Commodore 64 person.
Yeah.
And that was kind of like where you basically had that distinct community, and some people were saying, oh, the Commodore 64 was better, or the, you know, the Spectrum was better. I had both, but the one that I probably spent most of my early days getting into hacking was actually with the Spectrum.
Okay.
Because one of the challenges you had was about copyright. You wanted to get the latest games, but you couldn't get them. And they came, that then was tape cassettes.
Okay, yep.
And with the tape cassettes, then they had this special code at the beginning, so you started getting into basically splicing. So you had to take the tape out, or you may have got a tape that was destroyed, so you had to go and try and repair it, or a certain part of the tape wasn't as readable. So you had to go and find ways to make sure you need to fix them. And that was really where you started exploring and making sure that you could, one, is bypass some of the regional locks, which was a pain. I'm pretty sure in Australia, you had the same problem, was that when games came out in America, then they had the regional locks, and you couldn't play them in Europe, you couldn't play them in Asia or Australia. So you had to try and find ways around them as well.
Yeah, that the region locking is also a thing. And also the difference between 50 hertz and 60 hertz gaming consoles is also the thing. And the classic example of that is Sonic the Hedgehog, on the Sega Mega Drive, or the Genesis for Americans. Now, in the Genesis runs at 60 hertz in America, so it's got this fairly upbeat do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do. But the 50 hertz version, because that's sort of like a different specifications of the power, they sort of didn't optimize it, so it just ran slower. Do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do. Now, in the Anglo world, we didn't know that it was different. We just thought that's what Sonic...
thought that's what it was expected.
That's how Sonic runs at. And then all of a sudden we find out later, Sonic's upbeat and he's moving around, and we're like, oh, crap.
Because that was the whole thing. It was much faster.
It was much faster because just that's the... Back then, the consoles were... The regions were also about the power and 240 volts versus 110 in America and different standards. So there was even that level. So yeah, you could remove a region lock on a game, but then the game might still actually be different.
Correct.
For some of the reasons you don't know.
And that was some of the things. So my early days was trying to get around those things. So I could play the games that I wanted to. And some of the things, you know, the tapes was all about splicing and, you know, removing the write protection and be able to, you know, copy games. You had to get two tape cassettes and record from one to the other. So those were a lot of the early kind of areas that, and even when you get into CDs had the magic bits around, so if you get a dark marker, you'd actually draw around so it could read them, and therefore you could actually then play the games that were region locked. So there's a lot of things, and even and the kind of, if you were the Nintendo, you would have, I think it was the Game Genie, and if you were a Sega person, you might have had the Game Shark. So those were basically the hardware mods that started coming out, where people basically to try and get around, and that was the ability to then, they came with all of these, because in the you know, 70s, 80s, and 90s, we had basically codes. If you wanted to, sometimes there was no save game. You couldn't save the game. So what you end up doing was you got So when you get to certain levels, it would reveal a specific code, or you get codes you had to enter to get back to where you were. One of the things, you know, games that I started recently playing was Dune, the Battle of Arrakis. And that was exactly that type of game. There was no save. What you'd end up doing, you got basically, as you progress, you could get the level unlocks. And a lot of these came with those pre-coded. And also they had the ability to overwrite certain parts of the menu to add lives, or to give you, let's say, special weapons, or to make you run faster, or to unlock certain levels or abilities. So these basically were hardware modules that you plug in the console, and then on top of that, you'd plug the game in. It was the ability to modify those bits as they went through.
So I think you are introducing very well where we're trying to go with this episode, which I think. So we can look at hacking as it pertains to games from actually three. I was going to say two, but you may now maybe realize it's three, old school. One could be the software. So I could take my Amiga game and it would be cracked. So the copy control was taken out. And anyone who's ever used an old Amiga 500 game, there's usually some sort of flashy screen that comes up and says, do you want infinite lives? Do you want level select? Do you want this? And that was called a trainer. And so they might remove the copy protection from the code. And then they might also add this trainer menu that would show up first, do you want cheats? So that's modifying the software.
Correct.
Then we've got modifying the hardware.
Correct.
So pure hardware. And that would be, I mean, getting in there, soldering.
Correct.
And so that, I'm trying to think of NES. Maybe on the NES, that might have been zapping the NES lockout chip. There were ways to sort of zap it. And so it will go, ooh, and let you use a fake cartridge in there.
Correct.
Or it could be, these days, the hardware hacking in a more modern time might be converting your 50 megahertz Sega Mega Drive to 60 hertz so it plays those faster ones. Or it might also be there are many, many modifications now for enhancing the audio and visuals. So on the Sega Mega Drive, it's called a triple bypass. And it's just this big old mod chip and you solder it in and it's getting the video signal earlier back in the chain and extracting it out, doing better work than the original did, and pumping out a cleaner analog signal or a HDMI. And what you kind of reminded me of, there was sort of this middle ground, which was a Game Shark or a Game Genie, as you said, where you would put in, it was a code. It was different to the level select code, a Game Genie code. And what that basically did is indicate to it which bytes to change.
Correct.
In the game.
In the memory.
In the memory. And that was sort of like live software hacking.
Correct. So it was in real time. It was happening. As you may have basically been doing, it allowed you to pre-configure it and it would change those bits into specific codes, hex codes. And then that would basically change the outcome of the game or your ability, adding lives, etc. So, which is actually very similar to what a lot of hackers do today. When basically if they're looking at basically, you know, gaining access to people's environments or systems or software, what they're simply doing is sometimes they're changing those bytes in real time. And sometimes you only need to change, you know, maybe 4 bytes in order to provide you a elevated privilege account or to be able to change the code so that you can actually remote access it. So that's exactly very similar, is that, you know, those early kind of methods of being able to unlock games are the exact same methods that attackers are using today to unlock access to people's environments. And that's where that very strong relationship, and also the communities are very similar as well. Even when I go to a lot of events, one of the great things I enjoy is a lot of the events have these sometimes gaming themes.
Okay.
And even this year in DEF CON in Las Vegas, or in 2023, they had the arcade area, which was fantastic. It allowed me to go back. Because one of my youths as well, I'm not sure about yours, that when you didn't have a games console, what you would end up doing is you'd go into the arcades. Sure. There was actually places you went to actually play the arcades.
Play the games, yeah.
And there was Galaga. There was Space Invaders. There was things like Street Fighter. There was lots of basically simulations that you'd actually play in the arcades. And that for me was an early, at DEF CON last year, they actually had the arcade theme where they actually had all these retro arcade games that you can go and play.
Sure.
And that was for me, is, you know, that community is very, very close, and the culture and the kind of ideas are very similar. It's all about either, you know, the right to repair is mm-hmm. one of the big things in, sure. in the community. And mm-hmm. that's where hardware hackers come in, is that they want to make sure that systems have a long life. Right. They want to be able to repair it whenever they want to. The right to be able to, you know, update it and secure it. The right to modify it to do what they want to do. So lots with a lot of the modifications come in. So mm-hmm. for me, that community and culture is very closely related. Mm-hmm. A lot of the techniques that I see attackers using today come out of that gaming retro, you know, sure. environment.
I would also say, as well, to add to that list of things that you said as right to repair, preservation.
Yeah.
And this is one that's often touted by people who say, well, it's, I'm not pirating, I'm preserving. And okay, there's a moral, and whether you want, I'm not going on the moral things here. But there's many examples where if, and this is a little bit more as we move into the digital era, if it wasn't preserved, it would have been lost. So we're removing, Sony is removing access to the PlayStation 3 store or something like that. If we don't, now you might say we don't have any right to that. Okay, I don't know. then those games are not available anymore. And there is a charm to having it available. Like my little cousins have a PlayStation 3. Mm-hmm. And my cousin in law, he's like, yo, should we just hack it? Like your one is. And I was like, yeah, but I already gave him a hacked Wii. And it's fine. They like that. And we play the hacked Wii. But I'm like, actually, you know what? I'm going to buy some PlayStation 3 games for them so they have that physical experience of opening a box, putting it in. I don't want to be the dick uncle, but I actually want them to not have every game. To replicate that experience of, we've only got three games, so I'm going to have to grind away at these three games because that's all I've got.
Yeah, it's going back to the old days of even TV, where we only had four TV stations.
There we go. So is that a little curmudgeonly of me? I'm not sure. Look, I'll get them a PS4 soon enough. Dory, he's like 12, right? So it's not a big
thing. But I think it's important because then it allows them to, you know, get good at one thing. Sure. Because one of the problems you have a lot is that what I see in today's you know, generation of kids playing games, they switch so quickly between games where they don't progress through the levels. They they do something, they have short attention spans, and they move to the next thing. When we only had a handful of games that you had to actually go through and you had to complete them, you had to go
through. How many games did you have on your Atari then? Because two old men sitting here discussing that, while I say, oh, they're kids and they've got all the games these days. When I think about it, I almost only had copied Amiga games, and I had a couple stacks of those old disc things.
Yep.
And I actually do reflect a little bit of, like, I had a Mega Drive with two games and an Amiga with 100 games. Which one did I like more? So how many actual cartridges did you have for this Atari?
So for the Atari, between the cartridges and the tape, because it also was able to use the tape, because that was one of the key things for the Atari, was I probably had a couple hundred. So a couple hundred games. The competition we had going was around completion.
Okay.
So for me, the completion, I probably completed just over 100 games or so from like complete start to finish. And one of the agreements we had was that not to change the level, you know, the difficulty level as well. So you had to leave it as the default. So
were they copy games or the originals?
They're definitely not all the originals.
Okay, yeah.
We also had the exchanging of games as well.
So, yeah, that's a big thing. So, sure, yeah, yeah.
So when you basically had completed a game, what you would end up doing is you'd exchange with a friend, so then you'd swap. So we had a large community of basically exchanging them.
Yeah.
And that was something that also was very important as well, so that you'd actually, you know, other people could reuse the games and try them as well, which is more difficult today because of all those, you know, ability that to share games is also challenging today, especially in the modern kind of consoles.
Definitely. I'm still as much as possible trying to buy physical discs. And I know there's a download, and I know they can lock you out whenever you want.
It takes up a lot of space as well. There's
a lot of space, but it still seems better to me than, like, I'm not going to get that, probably that Microsoft, whatever, the XS that's got no disc drive. I'm like...
I'm still a bit old school. I like to have the physical, the discs or the cartridges or whatever, you know, or local on the hard drive. I like to have it local. Then you can mostly sometimes play offline as well, which is also, you know, one of the things my kids complain about is I can't pause because I'm playing online. Sure. I'm like, well, I can't. So, but I think it's definitely an area that for the less games I had, the more I focus on completing them and understanding. Some of my old games I remember the most was Chucky Egg. Chucky Egg was one of my old classics. And then the Treasure of Monkey Island, which is being re-brought back again, which is fantastic. So Monkey Island was one of also my all-time classics.
It's the secret of Monkey Island. The Treasure of Monkey Island. But it's okay.
Was it
a secret of Monkey Island? Sorry,
the new one. Correcting me, which is good. So, other one was R-Type was also one of my all kind classic of favorites.
Shooter, yeah.
Yeah. So, 1943 was it?
Sure, that's another. So, scrolling shooter.
Starflight, which was kind of one of the more strategy games, which that I probably was the one that I spent the most hours on because it was a very huge. It was a big game. And to complete that took many, many hours. I think I had so many, there's probably sleepless nights playing that game.
So do you think that children this day, or young people, let's say, growing up, still are able to get that joy of hacking? Because when for us, it was still achievable. And you can still achieve it today by going back and just hacking an old system. But is a PS3, you know, the game, or it's so complicated that I can't just go and add a trainer or a level or something like that. And did that ability to experiment, that hobby side of it, that playing around side, did that contribute to hacker culture? And what does that mean for the future?
Absolutely. I mean, that's what, you know, it absolutely did contribute to the hacker culture that we have today. All of the, you know, even a lot of the young generation, they go back to the old school in order to learn.
Sure. Okay, so you can still learn from the old stuff.
You can still learn from the old stuff because it still has relevance.
Yeah.
But the new modern gaming scenario is much more difficult for kids to understand about modifying them. They do look for ways around them. Sure. They are exploring them. You know, they are looking for basically either codes or unlocks or ways to simulate. So that still is happening today. But it's not as easy. It's not that combination of hardware and software.
If you were a hacker kid, or you had a kid that had such inclinations today, maybe in the old days you'd get in there and hack some hex and binaries and stuff like that. Maybe today it's like, oh, I'll download a copy of Unreal Engine and fool, or I'll download some gaming engine and fool around with that. It's not hacking as such, but it's programming.
Yeah, it's programming. I mean, when you think about is that a lot of the, you know, we look at, you know, even some of the large gaming distributors and companies today. When we go look, even, you know, a lot of gamers are trying to, you know, some would be trying to upload their games and bypassing some of the restrictions, some of the reviews, so they automatically upload it. So that was one of the most recent ones. I think it was in Steam. In order to bypass the Steam engine's basically detection, and then basically get it published, and those would either, you know, allow them to get money quicker, or it actually contained malicious code as well. So some of the things that those engines have to be aware of, and then also targeting. If you look at the recent attack on Rockstar with the Grand Theft Auto, the guy who actually did it, he was actually the hacker was from the Lapsus Group. He was on bail. From basically after hacking NVIDIA. So he'd hacked NVIDIA and was now on bail, staying at a hotel, and ended up using an Amazon Fire Stick with a phone, keyboard, mouse, and stuff, and using that, hacked into Rockstar, and then basically was able to capture pre-release images and videos off Grand Theft Auto. So you look at, you know, there's that, it was one of those, you know, hacking the games, but also hacking the companies as well. One of the big things that I recently got into was, because I do a lot of reverse engineering, so I, and when you're doing reverse engineering, what that means is you're using disassemblers, which takes basically existing code or execution and reverses it back into original assembly language. So that's what a lot of reverse engineers do, is basically they're using things like IDA, they're using Immunity Debugger and other types of tools, and that will revert the code that they have in the binary into the assembly code. And for me to learn, what I went back and actually started doing was going back and actually coding in assembly. And actually creating games. So, because a lot of the Atari games were written in, the 2600 were written in basically assembly language, which was the MOS CPU, MOS processor, the 6502, if I remember. So I actually went back, in order to become better at understanding and reading assembly code, I actually went back and started writing games in that assembly language. Which was, you know, it's a very good, I think actually it'd be great for the younger generation also to really start to learn how things work behind the scenes, because that's really where you start to understand about how things really work when you want to get into modifying, or you want to understand about changing hexes and changing configurations and be able to become better at something, is understanding how it works in the background, understanding how it works behind the scenes. And that's what a lot of hardware hackers do, is they want to modify things to do something differently. Whether they want to modify their smart kettle to send emails or to do DDoS attacks, or they want basically to, some of the interesting things is around controllers. I've seen a massive industry around making fun things out of controllers, or actually making controllers out of interesting things as well.
A friend of mine, Robert Dale Smith, you want to check him out, and he's a dude who's been modifying those Fisher-Price kids controllers and turning it into a genuine controller by using a couple of Raspberry PIs on the inside of that.
So, and that's I mean, one of the things as well is for me to stay, because one is I love retro gaming still today. And the problem I have got is getting access to some of the old hardware is becoming more and more difficult. And also takes up a lot of space. So I think probably similar to yourself, as I went into the emulation world, is using emulators. And that's also a lot of areas where to take old things and be able to play them in modern systems today. I mean, Windows has been great because Windows backwards compatibility, and Windows 11 today, you can still run DOS programs from the 70s and 80s, and will still run today.
Pretty amazing.
Which is impressive when you think about backwards compatibility. But if you look at even some of the games consoles, is that backwards compatibility ends with version 3 and 4, which is, that's sometimes what frustrates me, is you bought a bunch of games for, let's say, even a PlayStation 2, and only the earlier versions of the PlayStation 3 could play those, and then later versions, you have to buy the 4 version. You might have it in the old console, but you can't play it later. So that's where the emulation came in, is that we can actually take those older games and play them in modern systems. So one of the things for me is I've taken a bunch of Raspberry Pis and made them Retro Pis. I've got a bunch of 8-bit do arcade sticks, the old style arcade controllers.
Yep, I got one of those, yeah.
And using those to kind of get that same feel. So I'm still today playing Sonic the Hedgehog, still playing Street Fighter, still playing R-Type, and even you recently got me into do Don Pachi.
Bullet Hell.
Oh my goodness! That is intense.
That is a good point that I hadn't thought about. So there's emulation, and to dive deeper into the idea of emulation. So a RetroPie is typically referred to as something called software emulation. So that's where someone's written some code on Windows, and it'll read the Super Nintendo file that's been dumped from a cartridge and accurately emulate it. Now, there's levels of accuracy. So then you could have something called a cycle accurate emulator, which is like, not just like, oh, I made it work, but it's like my internals work the same as those internals. Then the other super nerdy level at the end of all of this is what's referred to as hardware emulation, which would be an FPGA platform. Which is a hardware chip that can be programmed to emulate another chip. So this chip can be giving certain instructions. It works functionally identically to that chip. So we've got, so you can have one big FPGA that's sitting there, and someone's, as you said, okay, I've programmed the Atari CPU, I've programmed or taken the schematics of how the Atari sound chip works, I piece them together in this FPGA, and that's hardware emulation, and it can often show weird quirks that were in the original hardware. They'll turn up there because it's a one-to-one recreation, and that's a very fascinating area because no one's programming CPUs, but they are doing a lot of FPGA development.
Yeah, they're doing basically the mapping of what it would have been before with modern processors. And one of the things is that it's important because, to your point, is that they play as they were originally. Because one of the things I find is sometimes there's a lag, or that the sound is not the same, or the visuals are a bit kind of off. So you do with the software emulations, it's not as clear or as accurate as it was in the original. But with the hardware emulations, you do sometimes even get it better.
Absolutely. So you can get a clean out of a platform like the Mr. FPGA. You can get a clean analog RGBS signal out of that as like it is the reference standard. So you can modify your Mega Drive with triple bypass and it should be as good as that. But then there's this other weird layer. So let's take the NES. So I want to get RGBS analog video out of that. The NES never did that. It never had the ability to produce that higher standard of that. And what a color is in the NES is unclear. So you can have the Mr. FPGA, it accurately, but because it, what composite, out of the composite video, what a color is wasn't completely set. So we're still interpreting again what that was due to the limitations of those original hardware.
Yeah, absolutely. And that was the difference. You know, you had a lot that basically, because when the games consoles came out then, it was about how many colors they could actually represent. Was like, you know, this can do 2 million colors. You know, even if you go back to the original, you know, the Ataris, it had like, what's it, three. So, and then you think about the progression over all those years about the capabilities that they had. And that's one of the things, you know, is that with the emulation side of things is that sometimes you're even getting much better results than they actually were originally. And even today, as you said, you're doing cathode displays, which is, there's not many, you know, there's a bunch of them around, but not many people use them. But to be able to take some of those older consoles and play them in modern TV sets or projectors or wherever it is, you also have to try and modify and make sure that the output is the same.
Oh, this is just a rabbit hole. A rabbit hole. So we can modify our console to output the best analog video. Okay, that combines very well with a CRT. But if you stick that into a flat panel, it might not go very well because it's sending in a very low quality signal and due to the way the flat panel works. So then we need something called a scaler in the middle. And so the scaler... And what it is you can't just get any, like a scaler meant for live video is not good for pixelated 8-bit retro games. Like the algorithm that upscales it isn't the same. So go into all of that. So then we've got devices like Mike Chi's RetroTINK 5X and the 4K, and they're designed, specifically designed that I'm expecting a retro game signal and I'm gonna blow it up. Now, where this is going further in the future, there are HDMI mods for many. Okay, they almost all have a HDMI mod these days. And where this is actually going, what I think, let's say I had like five old consoles and I want to play them all on my flat screen. Where I think this is going is that we will have a very simple HDMI mod in each of them that will just output basically what the 480p the 240p line double to 480p, and it'll just output that. And then we're going to have an external scaler that'll take all of those, take the 480p, and then upscale it rather than having that that upscaling technology in each thing. So cheaper HDMI mods in each machine. And I'm already seeing things like that on the Nintendo 64. There's a friend of mine, he lives in Sweden, and he's a N64 hacker, and he's made an N64 HDMI mod basically out of a Raspberry Pi.
Okay, so everything's basically gone through and being upscaled into the TV, so you only have one device.
One device doing the upscaling, it'd be a RetroTINK 4K or something like that, and then having very cheap as possible HDMI mods that are just basically taking analog video, converting to digital, and then pushing it back out to an external scaler. That's where I think that... Well, I mean, and that's a rabbit hole. I'm sorry for boring you on. This is what I know about, right?
So, but no, I think that's definitely... You know, one of the things is that I find that that's definitely going to be not even just for older consoles, but as we kind of move through formats, you know, that's going to become something that's going to become needed in the future for sure, to make sure that we can still use old stuff. And having that life cycle, you know, I find that, and this is going back to that right to prepare, and one thing you mentioned is to preserving things for longer life, is we don't want to have something that, you know, after 2 years you can't use it anymore. And that's what a lot of, you know, the devices I had lasted, you know, 10, 15 years. Even some of my old stuff that I still have in my office, basically, is still working from like 30 years ago. I can still use it. But the problem is that newer hardware is having a 2, 3, maybe maximum 4 years of a life cycle. And for me, that's not what we were used to.
No, and there's an argument there about like a planned obsolescence and from that stage. But then there's also an argument about, well, we're just losing a piece of art.
Exactly.
So that then the art's gone, and we no longer can enjoy that piece of art anymore. I think it's sort of a dual-sided.
Yeah, it's, and it's also making sure that, you know, we're not going to waste. We're not creating waste. We should be making sure, you know, it's, mm-hmm. it's one of the environmental aspects of things, is that when you had something that could last for a lot longer, you had no need, you know, you and that's where a lot of hardware hackers came from, is making sure that things, they could repair things.
Mm-hmm.
That was a lot of, you know, I had a PlayStation 3 that the Wi-Fi module went on it, which meant that one is that you can no longer use the controllers using wireless, and you also couldn't connect to the Wi-Fi. So everything had to be now cabled. And going, you know, to repair that, it was, you know, there's nowhere that does it. So you actually have to do it yourself.
Right.
And that's where you really get into, is you want to make sure that devices last as long as they possibly can and forever.
That's a good point about that repairing consoles. A friend of mine, his online handle is Voltar. He's a great hardware hacker. And one of the little chips that you can buy from him, so there's a problem with the Nintendo Wii U, the NAND chip, the sort of main internal little bit of memory, it's dying. And it's dying, being corrupted, and it's basically just bricking Wii U's, and it's becoming a problem.
Mm-hmm.
So he designed sort of this little PCB jig that will sit over there, and it will replace the NAND with just an SD card. Mm-hmm. So it's a failure of the machine. They're dying, they're bricking. It's a design. It's a bad design. Or maybe just, okay, whatever. And yeah, that is something. It's not just upscaling or making better. It's like repairing a common fault in that console. Yeah, and now those ways. Making it better. Well, making it better. It, not improving the functionality. No. Making it work again from zero to working. If it's that's better. So there's that repairability of, we need to come up with some modern solution to repair this old hardware.
Yeah, and that's actually, you know, one of the things that I find is that when I talk a lot to hardware hackers, that is their ethos. That's their main goal, is to make sure that these devices can be preserved, and that when batteries die, or when chips, you know, fail, or when they were designed, you know, not great in the first place, is that their whole goal is to make sure, one is the right to repair, is that the right to longevity, and the right to be able to preserve that for a lifetime. And that's the main goal. And during that process, they might find vulnerabilities, which they disclose. They might be able to do interesting things with it. One of the great hardware hackers we had on a recent podcast episode was Sick Codes.
Mm-hmm.
And what he had done was, he's done multiple hardware hacks over the years, but he was able to take a John Deere tractor and take the console, you know, for the tractor itself, and play Doom on the console. And I've seen, now we've had this whole community afterwards, is that after he did that, he did mods to make it work, is that what's happened is that there's been a bunch of other hardware hackers later who've been playing it on things like MRI scanner, you know, hospital devices, and so forth. So there's this community that can continue that onwards.
So I want to ask you then, Joseph, about the balance between, so it's not cheap to produce a modern video games console.
Absolutely.
No doubt requires hundreds of millions, billions, whatever. So that company needs some protection for their return on investment. I can get it. We have many, several key examples of where piracy has killed a platform.
Absolutely.
Too soon.
Mm-hmm.
So that was the original Famicom. That was the Sega Dreamcast. Dreamcast also had that. So clearly there needs to be some protections in there for them to get their return on investment, meaning we get a console. But how long does that go on for? How long can the maker, like, when does Sony not give a shit about the PS3, PS4 anymore? They still care about the PS3 and it's super old.
Yeah,
you know, where's that balance of, I want the right to repair, I want to use it forever, I want to hack it, but I get that if they don't get some software protection or piracy protection, we'll never have it in the first place. What's Absolutely. The balance?
So I completely agree. Is that I think that what the right to repair is that there should be, make sure that there is the ability to do it after a certain period of time.
Okay.
Is when they decide to end of life it. When this console is no longer available, they're no longer selling it, they're no longer producing and making money off it, then you get into this open source side of things where you have the right to repair. And I think this is really where you can look at one of the great books that I read recently was Console Wars. And it was the exact same thing, is that when Nintendo and Sega were battling it out. And the Console Wars, it definitely a great read for the audience. It was, for me, it was also, showing the big conglomerate, company, which was Nintendo at the time. And then you had this, new energetic Sega that wanted to kind of penetrate the market. But what happened was is that they'd locked the complete supply chain in mm-hmm. to themselves,
yeah.
Which meant that exclusivity. You had to have their console to play this game, mm-hmm. And those game creators could not make it for other because it was exclusive mm-hmm. rights. And that really locked down the market. It meant it was a monopoly.
But there's a good reason that Nintendo did that is because of the Atari video games crash. So the Atari 2600 had unlimited pirates, and that just caused the bubble, which caused the crash. Correct. So then Nintendo, you might argue, overcorrected by becoming crazy locked down. You couldn't just make your own cartridge. You had to buy cartridges from Nintendo. You could only push out so many games per year. Crazy restrictions because they had monopoly. But you can also see
absolutely
why they got there.
I completely agree why they got there, but they did overcorrect. They sure. did do it too much, okay. where basically they locked a lot of... because, you know, that whole scenario resulted in some amazing games. Mm-hmm. That the competitiveness is good. And to make sure that it also it brings the price down. It makes it much more affordable for a lot of people. Mm-hmm. It also makes it much more for game creators to create. But yes, absolutely, the privacy side of things and also locking things down. I agree with it. But when those devices become end of life, mm-hmm. obsolete, people want to be able to continue using them. And I think the limitations on preventing that hardware from working, I think there's some companies you've seen in recent years, some audio devices mm-hmm. that decided that, okay, we're end-of-lifing it, so you can no longer use it. Mm-hmm. And I think I disagree with that. Okay. If you bought the hardware and you decide to no longer support it, and this is where we get into the, I've had discussions where not only the right to repair, but also it's when you get into is the right to even warranties, mm-hmm. security updates as well. When that device is no longer be able to get security updates, is that should other people be able to create it for free on the open source market?
Okay.
So yes, there should be security warranties. There definitely is hardware warantees, mm-hmm. but when they expire, when they're longer valid, I think this is where organizations should be willing to say, okay, this platform is no longer something that, of course, you might be certain parts of it that you're using in your modern systems, and you mm-hmm. might want sure. to try and continue those to be proprietary and to be locked out. Mm-hmm. But for the rest of it, the right to prepare the schematics, the things that are commonly problems, open up the community and let the hardware hackers be able to make it great. Mm-hmm. Because what that does is it makes the brand of the company much more acceptable and much more... it's not that I have to choose you because you're the only one, mm-hmm. but I choose you because you're doing the right thing and you're doing great things. And you make it, it's a two-way...
I love what you're saying. I just can't see Sony doing it. No. Like, I keep thinking about the PS3 right now because maybe it's at that stage of its life. PS4 yeah. still selling games. I get it. Fine. Mm-hmm. PS3, it's long gone. They are not selling consoles. They make this money of hardware. Well, they're not making PS3 games anymore. So it's done. For an income, and they've closed down the PS3 store. So then what? So, okay, so should they open source those designs, allow us to update it? What if there's still Sony proprietary code and chips embedded in the middle of that?
If there is proprietary, I think that's where they have, if they're still using that in current systems or then absolutely, that's what they want to protect. But areas, for example, common failures in old systems, the areas that actually commonly break, mm-hmm. Whether it being the hard drive or whether it being those Wi-Fi chips, is that you might say for those specific parts, here's the schematics and here's how you can fix it. Mm-hmm. So making that more open. I think Apple has actually done a pretty good job with that more recently, even though they've made it more difficult to take apart the devices because mm-hmm. everything's been glued. So some organizations are making the right to repair a little bit more, they're still controlling it. They're still having official representatives and stuff, but they're making it more available. I think companies like Microsoft, here and there, Nintendo not and Sony not. Sure. Those are two companies where the whole systems are around proprietary and locking things down.
I think that's also, you said three examples and they were all video games console manufacturers. Mm-hmm. And I think that is different to John Deere. I think that is different to some other piece of consumer hardware that you might have around your house. They're just really different industries, different mm-hmm. microsystems. Like Microsoft, I get why no one, like Microsoft got so screwed by the Xbox mm-hmm. being hackable. I guess Sony got so screwed by, because they don't make money on the hardware. Mm-hmm. They're making money on that software sales. So they need...
Nice subscription.
Right.
It's all about subscriptions.
Sure, they want to take that away.
Yeah.
I think there's got to sort of look at these industries a little bit differently because the console, even back to when we were growing up again, the console, I never understood consoles at first. I'm like, I got an Amiga. It can be programmed. Why do I even need this other thing? That the idea that there was, and I know what I'm doing. I can load the disc. I can copy the disc. I'm clever. But there were people that just wanted to insert the cartridge and have a go.
I think from that culture side of things is that, and one is that, you know, there's the us who want to consume, but then there's also those who are making money in the piracy side of things. The criminal gangs and the those marketplaces that went up that makes it much more widespread. I think those are the ones that was definitely stopping the sales and taking money away from the companies. I was willing to pay money for the game. It was more accessibility. Mm-hmm. It was more about
that's a good point.
Getting the game versus actually, you know, not paying for it or getting it at an affordable price as well.
At least now, in the current generation, we don't have region locks anymore.
Which is...
massive.
Well, you do... Today, it's more... It's no longer regional locks, but it's content locks.
Okay, sure.
So they've moved into where, in certain locations, you may not get certain content. So if you look at into the streaming market, there may be... Here in Estonia, we might have different content on Spotify or Netflix or games that you might not have in other regions.
Sure.
So they're getting into now...
So use NordVPN to get access.
So VPN is one way that many get around it. But definitely, it's moving away from those traditional regional to content.
Mm.
And the content now has specific locations where it's allowed to go.
Sure.
So that's where you get into the subscription side, is where you've subscribed to, whether it being the PlayStation Plus or whatever, you know, PlayStation Store, or you've got the Microsoft. Now you have access, but those content are limited per country and per location.
Mm.
So it's even more, not just about region 1, region 2, 3, and 4, and 5, and so forth. Now it's about country A, country B, country C,
sure,
and those content-specific locks. So VPN is one that many people get around it. That's what they use.
Yeah, okay. So what they giveth, they taketh away as well. So yes, I can go to Japan, buy a Nintendo Switch, just play the game, and there's no region locks, and that's fun. But okay, if we're talking about media, other services, I mean, maybe... I'm trying to think in video games industry... I don't know. Are there like DLCs locked region?
From a hardware perspective, I haven't seen, even because for anyone who was going to consume the games consoles, one of the things was that the limitations you had was the regional lock and the power and and the output for the TV.
Yeah,
those were the three things that you would have, you know, limited. Saying, well, one is that the power supply in the US is different from Europe, so therefore you want to get something from European power. The other one was the region lock, so if I bought a US one, I would have to only get games from the US. And then the third one was around the output of the TV and the hertz, 60 to 50 hertz.
PAL, NTSC, C-CAM.
So, and that would basically be your kind of decisions about what you're buying. Today, most things are powered through, you know, USB or universal, basically, power, USB-C. And it just means that you know, I don't have to worry about the power difference between North America, other than the plug itself, the adapter. Now you have basically, there's no region locked, but there is content locked. But of course, that's around where you're accessing it from. So if I travel and go to different places, you're going to get the content from that region, unless you use a VPN.
What do you know about, do you know anything about the EU's efforts to normalize that and say, nah, you can't differentiate between EU countries? Is that something you know about?
So they are getting into this, digital rights, you know, in the EU, is that what they're looking to do is having that across, equalizing it. So there's Digital Services Act,
right,
which is basically getting into making sure that everyone has equal content at the same time. And that got, I mean, there's great things that got away with roaming charges that we all had, so, which was a pain. It also meant that, you know, from a taxation and also accessibility. So it's really made things much more equal across, and also everyone getting it at similar times.
But have we seen that trickle down to consumer services like Netflix not having a show in Germany but not having it on Estonian Netflix
Not yet.
Not yet. Not okay. Yet.
It's still that still is there, but I'm hoping at some point in time that it gets opened up. I think it sometimes comes down to sometimes different countries have different age, okay. You know, for PG 13 and stuff. So there's different restrictions. So not all countries have equal for that. So sometimes they have to modify it. Sometimes it also comes down to some countries require you to have it in the subtitles of the language.
Okay, sure.
So from basically a localization perspective as well. So you might not have, you know, it ready for Estonian subtitles until a certain date. And that's when... Sure. But a lot of that today is being eliminated. Things like basically automation and artificial intelligence, that those things can be done, you know, within seconds. You know, it's you don't have to go through. But of course, there's a review and the restrictions that sometimes they have to get into. But I do see that either, you know, being eliminated with automation and AI in the future, or at least the time that that takes to be significantly reduced, where it comes out immediately across
all. Right, because I can see Netflix complaining and going, oh, we've got to make Estonian subs and Latvian subs and add all of that for all these other countries, and they've made a business decision. Ain't no one paying for stuff in Estonia. There's only five of us here, so we're not going to bother to localize it for that Estonian market. And okay, the EU might say, well, tough luck. If you want to deal with all of us, you've got to deal with 26 languages or whatever it is.
Right. And that automation, I mean, the translation is so quick today, you know, with machine learning and deepfakes, you know, you can simply use that in order to translate it immediately. We're even having, you know, the whole virtual assistance and virtual world. So for me, I think that will be something that should disappear as technology improves, rather than actually from basically, you know, the vendors and suppliers and services themselves. So I'm curious yourself, what games are you still playing? Are you still gaming much today, or what games are you still playing?
I in my old age, I love a big controller. Like, I love something that I can hold, something physical. Maybe it's my little movement against all this digital stuff. So I'm playing the new Dodonpachi release on PlayStation 4. DOJ got re-released recently by M2 Shot Triggers. It's an excellent port of a classic version of Dodonpachi. And it's on PS4. I've got a very nice PS4 stick, like a big arcade stick. And that is one that is powered actually by hardware hacking. So it's arcade sticks are quite easy. Buttons are really just on and off little switches. Yeah. But it's like the circuit board. And that could be one that is a Microsoft one that's going to the Xbox. Now, we can get ones that you plug those into a Raspberry Pi. And there is a way to hardware hack the key off an original PlayStation controller and then upload that into the Raspberry Pi, and then the Raspberry Pi is then appearing like a genuine PlayStation controller to the PS4. You can buy a board that can do this, or I just got a Pi and installed it myself. So I'm playing on a PS4 with a nice arcade stick. Besides that, I've also got a nice steering wheel set up with a nice T300 Thrustmaster wheel, a couple of pedals. So I might be playing Assetto Corsa or Gran Turismo 7 or something like that.
Likewise. I've been playing basically either it's the WRC as well.
Okay, nice. Yeah. Have you got some sort of wheel, or are you playing a controller?
Playing with the wheel.
Oh, good.
So we have the full seat set up.
Oh, cool.
You know, wheels, pedals, gear, shifter.
Oh, that's cool.
So it's pretty cool.
First of all, you've got room for all that stuff? Not bad. Okay.
I don't have a lot of room for that. Okay. So we have a group of guys who rotates around. At certain parts of the year, we decide who's going to store it and use it, so that we don't have like taking up space all the time. But definitely the way, you know, it's a fun way to just let some steam off and just basically, you know, test your driving skills in the WRC. For me, some of the old games I'm still playing R-Type. R-Type is one that I go to. It's a very difficult game. It's, you know, afterwards you end up with your hands are so tired basically from, you know, shooting. But I've also went to, I use a RetroPie mostly, and with a 8-bit2 arcade stick, because I do like the block. I do like that, you know, it brings back the old time from the arcades itself.
Sure, that feeling of that,
Being in the, you know, and also it allows you to do a lot of the moves and this, you know, special sequences much easier rather than a control pads, because I always find the D-pad, you know, that pad that you're trying to do, you can't get the same feeling.
It's not the same. For Street Fighter 2, I grew up the same, watching in the arcades for a shooter like R-Type. No, you need the
You need the controller. Yeah.
You need that stick. And so even there's so many different ways of hardware hacking here. One is like, so I was talking to you previously about, I've done work on lag testing controllers. And there's a setup you can use with a Mr. FPGA, and you have to solder onto that. So the FPGA Mr. fires off a button press via and then that goes back into that, and it's measuring the round trip. And that's how we're accurately measuring controller lag. Mm-hmm. And that's done with, you know, special bits of hardware. Or screen lag, so measuring display lag. And that's done with a device called a Time Sleuth. And it's basically a HDMI signal generator with a little photo strobe in it. And the cable comes out, goes to the TV, it starts strobing, and it's got its own little photo sensor. And so again, it's measuring the round trip. So this hardware hacking, and it's not even hacking, that's like a totally new thing. Is very common.
That's one of the reasons, you know, for this episode itself is that whole such overlap between the hardware hacking and the gaming, and all of this comes together, because a lot of those techniques is the same things that hardware hackers in my industry has been using for many years, was whether being into the radio hacking, radio signals, into Wi-Fi, into Bluetooth, you know, even basically from, you know, getting into even modifying signals. So really kind of there's such an overlap in this industry, which is impressive, that even though they kind of they slightly move along side by side and sometimes use techniques from each other, is that I think the community kind of can learn from each other for sure. So, but it's been an interesting, for me, you know, I love it. It's what got me into the industry, and it's something you're still doing today. I do find my controller does have periodically a lag. So when I'm playing, if I'm playing Mario Brothers, sometimes you're going, and that one little button push, and all of a sudden he's still running, and you're going, no.
It can be with a Pi. That could be in the Pi. That could be in the Pi software. Lag is a hard one to work out sometimes. Yeah. What I do know is your 8-bit arcade stick is very good. So it's not that.
I know, and I've tried different. I do find when the cable's connected that it is much better. I do find basically, because you have in the arcade stick itself, you've got three options. You've got the 2.4 gigahertz dongle.
Yep.
You have the cable, or you can go Bluetooth. When I do find the Bluetooth, it sometimes can be a bit, you know, if you've got a lot of signals around you, you might get a bit of a kind of overlap. If you use a dongle, it's pretty good. And if you use the cable, pretty good. But I do think it's in my Pi. I did change. I was using a 3 and I did move to the 4. I'm interested to see if the 5 will
a little bit faster.
A little bit faster.
My measurements of the 8-bit DOE arcade stick is that the Bluetooth, the 2.4 and the cable, they're all pretty similar. Yes, there's some microseconds, milliseconds between them, but more or less, none of them is bad. So what that tells me is that if you feel the cable is better, that's probably the Bluetooth stack or something around that having a problem inside of the Pi is where it's at. And okay, the U2 probably, and the likely. USB connection is bypassing that.
Yep. Something that I'm going to have to look at, and we'll probably look at together. So look, it's been fantastic having you on the show, and it's really kind of chatting and talking about gaming. Nice,
Without waiting for the lag.
That's something. Yeah, that's, and for the audience, definitely, I'm pretty sure that definitely follow Lewis on his podcast as well. And look forward to having more conversations and more discussions about gaming. I've got this urge now to go on to play some retro games. So
thanks very much.
So many thanks for being on the show. Many thanks for having a great conversation. For the audience out there, definitely go and kind of take a look at some of the, we'll make sure that all the things we talked about are on the show notes. And tune in every 2 weeks for the 401 Access Denied podcast. Really kind of talking about, for many of the audience out there who are in the hacking world, you're going to probably feel so much kind of overlap in the discussions we have had around the retro gaming world and some of the old school things around, you know, the reverse engineering to modding the hardware, to modding the software, to the signals, to basically getting around restrictions and copyrights and right to repair. So it's been a fantastic conversation. Many thanks for on the show. And everyone out there, take care and stay safe, and see you soon.
Thanks, Joseph. Thank you.
This podcast is brought to you by Delinea, the number one privileged access management solution for enterprises with complex hybrid IT environments. You can get our free ebook, Privileged Access Management for Dummies, by visiting us at delinea.com/PAM for Dummies. That's delinea.com/PAM4Dummies. From all of us at Delinea, thanks for listening.